This is Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe. Now, here's Patrick McEnroe.
All right, time for another edition of Holding Court, everyone. Patrick McEnroe here, and it truly is an honor to have one of the groundbreaking people in all of the world of professional tennis. She's been, I don't know if it's because you've been involved in the game for so long, and that's one notch on your record. It's Ann Worcester, by the way, who now is the president of UTR, the Universal Tennis Rating, which I absolutely want to get into that with you, Ann. But first I want to ask you, because you were the first ever female CEO, okay, of any major sports organization. In this case, of course, it was the WTA Tour, and you were just a young buck. Well, you're still young, but you were in your 30s at that point, which was amazing. Then you went on, obviously, to run the Connecticut Open for, I think, about 20 years. So before we get into, like, the business side of it and all you've done there in UTR, how did you just get into tennis at all? Did you play tennis as a junior? How did you get into the game?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. It's great to be with you. Twice in 1 week, right?
That's right. We did a little Zoom call. Yep.
We did. That was fun. I played tennis all my life. I came from a tennis family. My parents actually taught lessons to, like, my friends, on Saturday mornings. And my dad always made us play matches in between. So I grew up playing, and, I was a good high school player and, captain of the team and all that. But I didn't play competitive events. We didn't have the means. And, of course, there was no UTR recognizing high school play. So right. I didn't even think about playing in college. So I went off to Duke University and thought, well, maybe I'll, try and walk on. Mm-hmm. And I literally was, like, on my way to try out first week of freshman year, which I was a little nervous about the academics and playing for a D1 team. And I just said, I don't want to be a professional tennis player when I grow up. Why am I going to spend 80 hours a week practicing and training and playing matches? So I literally turned around and walked back to my dorm, and I saw and I saw this sign that said, join the Oktoberfest committee. And in high school and in junior high, I organized lots of things, student council. I organized proms and senior trips and all that. So I joined the Oktoberfest committee, and for 4 years, I got totally caught up in the student union, organizing plays and concerts and movies and speakers and Oktoberfest and Springfest. And, like, literally, my parents would call me and say, are you studying? Like, we're really happy that you love all this volunteer work, but, like, we sent you for an education.
Right.
And then senior year, I was super confused. I was an economics major, but I was minoring in the Palestinian problem and Middle East relations. And senior year, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was interviewing on Wall Street, thinking about, like, the Peace Corps and kind of everything in between. That's how confused I was. And this guy walked up to me on the quad and said, hi, my name is Todd McCormick, and we have some friends in common, and I know what you do here at Duke with the student union. I think you'd be perfect for my father's company, IMG.
Wow, okay.
And so, so talk about, like, kismet. So he wanted me to go work on the Pope's trip to London and, work for free and fly myself over there, and I did not have the means to do that. Mm-hmm. And I had student loans to pay. So I went off to Spain to work as an au pair, and just because I wanted to improve my Spanish, because I knew the only thing I knew is I wanted something international. Mm-hmm. And my Spanish was junior high school level. So I went off to Spain, worked as an au pair, came back 6 months later, went to visit a Duke friend in Lexington, Kentucky, and bumped into Todd McCormick, believe it or not.
Just by chance.
He was teaching at the same Montessori school as my girlfriend, TJ. Hmm. So we all go out to dinner, and he said, now, why didn't you ever, follow up with IMG? And I said, well, I really couldn't afford to go take that volunteer job in London. Mm-hmm. And so he told me again what IMG was all about, and I was probably much more prepared to listen. And so the next day, he sent my resume to his father. And literally the only entry-level opening in the whole company was in racket sports. Hmm. So like 1 month later, I was starting work at the U.S. Pro Championships at Longwood Cricket Club outside of Boston.
Boston, Massachusetts.
Remember that tournament?
Sure.
On clay, like followed Stratton or something. And I was literally answering the phones and taking ticket orders, Patrick, making $250 a week with my Duke honors degree.
Wow.
And all my friends thought I was completely crazy.
Well, now, and, well, like, now I know where you got your skill, because, you know, with the Connecticut Open, I mean, you always came up with the most unbelievable ideas. You were so far ahead of your time when it came to, you know, the entertainment to have for fans. So now I know it was all those years doing the Oktoberfest at Duke. Because, I mean, that was like old hat for you.
That's funny. That's a good point. Yeah, I was always kind of in the entertainment business. And, so we took great pride in sort of turning the, you know, sort of wrapping the live tennis at the Connecticut Open with a festival of fun and you know, entertaining events and amenities all week long. So, yeah.
I must say I'm a little bummed.
Probably started back at Duke.
Yeah, I must say I'm a little bummed, though, that you didn't scratch that itch to try to get on the Duke team. I mean, it's amazing to hear that story. But
I wonder what would have happened. I wonder.
I thought you were going to say when you were senior, you decided to go for the team and you made it. You know, you made the team, and then – but that didn't happen. Okay, so you go to IMG and you spend how many years there – And how did your job evolve there?
So, you know, because I spoke Spanish, they put me in the player liaison role, and, you know, when I wasn't selling tickets. And then they kind of, promoted me to corporate sales, and I worked on different tournaments up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And then they had this partnership with Butch and Cliff Buchholz to run the first ever Lipton International Players Championship in Delray Beach at Laver's. Remember that?
I sure do. Absolutely.
And so they sent me down to be the ticket manager of this 2-week, 28-session tournament being played in like a 14,000-seat stadium. And needless to say, I was in so way over my head. And so, you know, somehow we got through and played the first year at Laver's and the second year at Boca West. And the second year, I was promoted to the director of corporate sales. So I was responsible for sponsorship, which, of course, was always my love.
Where the real money comes to support these tournaments, right?
Yeah, exactly. The backbone. And so, and then I went back up to Philadelphia, worked for Marilyn Fernberger.
Sure.
And in Philadelphia doing corporate sales. And then I had this, IMG came back to me and said, would you like to go back to Spain? And we have a partnership with Manolo Santana, and we're going to run 8 tournaments and exhibitions in 1987. And we would like one of our own to go over there and be on his team. So I said, absolutely. So I went back to Spain, and instead of being like a babysitter or a nanny, I, you know, had a real job, and I lived in Madrid and traveled all over the country, and we ran events in Palma de Mallorca, Marbella, Barcelona, Madrid.
Wow.
And it was, I lived in this great apartment hotel in the middle of Madrid, and I was always traveling to great places.
Mm-hmm.
And Manolo was very, very progressive. Most men just assumed I was the secretary.
Mm-hmm.
But Manolo was like, here's half my desk. And he let me manage player relations, media relations, sponsorship, public relations. I mean, he really gave me a ton of responsibility. My Spanish, got better and better.
Right.
And I had the greatest year. And I almost stayed. It was, you know, very unusual to be a female working in sports marketing in 1987 in Spain. So I got a lot of interesting offers for the World Fair and the Barcelona Olympics. But I knew if I stayed, I'd probably never come home, and I didn't want to be away from my family and my parents on Long Island. So, because I grew up in Syosset.
Okay, yeah,
right,
sure.
Next to Oyster Bay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
So came back and got this fantastic job with Virginia Slims as the director of global operations when Virginia Slims was, you know, the title sponsor of, you know, the tour.
Right.
And so we had 17 Virginia Slims named events in the United States in major markets, Virginia Slims of Chicago, Virginia Slims of Philadelphia, Virginia Slims of LA. I mean, that was the heyday of American tennis.
Mm-hmm.
All culminating at the Virginia Slims Championships at Madison Square Garden.
Unbelievable.
And then I traveled to the Grand Slams and the other majors to just to ensure compliance and mm-hmm. manage player relations. And it was an amazing role. And then I was Virginia Slims representative on the Women's Tennis Council, which was the then governing body with players and tournaments
and let me just chime in for a second, because at this time you're like in your late 20s, early 30s, right?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
I'm 31. Yeah,
31.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm 31.
Yeah.
And I get recruited to succeed Jane Brown mm-hmm. as the managing director of the Women's Tennis Council
right.
at 31 years old. And so that was a giant stretch and step, you know, as a huge learning curve and a huge teaching moment for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was 3 years and, you know, Monica Seles getting stabbed.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Having to ban Mary Pierce's father and mm-hmm. all kinds of other really, really difficult, challenging situations. And we also went through this integration of the Women's Tennis Council acquiring the then Player Association so that we could become one WTA tour, because the tobacco sponsorship was running out. We were mm-hmm. going to have to go it alone. For the first time ever, we'd be the WTA tour instead of the Virginia Slims Series. Big, big changes.
Right.
And so we were looking for a CEO, that the sport was looking for a new CEO. The players came to me and said, we want you to be, we need a very strong leader in this new format. We no longer have a player association. We want you to be our lead board rep and help us with all of our, you know, issues and policies. And I signed a contract with them. And somewhere in there, I met my husband literally as I was leaving Philip Morris
mm-hmm.
And we wanted to start a family, you know, started thinking about moving to Connecticut. So I was going to have this great job representing the players in this new world and, you know, start a family.
Mm.
And the Women's Tennis Council board, the players and the tournaments and the ITF and the Grand Slam couldn't agree on the next CEO. And so I'll never forget, I was in the restroom during the U.S. Open board meeting, and Martina and I think it was Pam Shriver,
yep.
Mary Jo,
yep.
yeah, cornered me and said, as much as we want you to be our leader in this new, you know, new model and new WTA tour model, everyone in that room can only agree on one person, and they would like you to be our next CEO and
wow.
the first CEO of the fully integrated mm-hmm. WTA tour. So nobody was more surprised than me, and then my husband.
Right, exactly. After we're going to settle down,
so,
right? Sure.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, honey, I can make this work. I can do this, and he completely supported me. God mm-hmm. bless him. And you know, so that's how it all came together in 1994, and. You know, it was a big integration of the Players Association, which brought us a lot of debt. We had a lot of financial turnaround to accomplish. And we wound up hiring IMG to help us find a new tour sponsor. And IMG challenged us to create international television pooling, because at that point, the tournament had all their domestic and international rights. So for the first time in the tour's history in 1995, we created television pooling, and the tournaments kept their domestic rights and sold their international rights to the tour. And thankfully, IMG hit it out of the ballpark, and you know, we like tripled tournaments' revenues in some cases. And then we also, you know, had a kind of a dearth of top names. It was like the Steffi Graf. You
sure.
know, show, and there was a sort of a burgeoning rivalry with Arantxa Sanchez Vicario, but Monica was still off the tour. Jennifer was off the tour. Gabriella retired in 1995. Chrissy had retired. Martina retired for the first time. So it was really, there was a dearth. That was when Sports Illustrated came out with that, you know, awful cover, "Is Tennis Dying?"
Right, right.
And so we said, okay, we got to do a much better job of telling these players' stories and teaching the next generation mm-hmm. that they have to take a much bigger role in the marketing and promotion of their sport. So that's when we created this ACES program that is still alive and well to this day, where players just had to change their mindset that their paycheck was not just for what happened on the court, but off the court, and that they had to contribute a lot. You know, they'd been handed this legacy, and they needed to participate much more in the marketing and promotion of their sport and do a lot more with hospital visits and fan-friendly visits and sponsor visits and all the stuff you see them doing now as, you know, as commonplace.
Yeah, and I think the players I think the players nowadays certainly know that that's part of the deal, particularly the younger players coming up now, you know, Naomi Osaka's and the six of passes on the men's side, they sort of know that that's part of the deal. So I want you to, you know, talk a little bit about how you, you know, obviously you were there in the those years in the WTA, then you spent 20 years at the Connecticut Open. So, you know, tell me a little bit about how you think it's the, not just women's tennis, but pro tennis has evolved and changed over these years. And then we'll get into the UTR, because I really want to talk to you about that as well. But just give me your overview of kind of where tennis has gone in these last 25 years.
You know, I think that there's a lot of really great things about tennis, but I think tennis is a fragmented sport. And as long as we keep sort of selling in silos, decentralization decreases value. And, you know, centralization would increase value. And when you look at our sport compared to football, you know, soccer, football, and golf, and, you know, pretty much every other sport, our revenues are minimal. And the Grand Slams, the four crown jewels. So, you know, there's probably 100+ ATP and WTA events, but the Grand Slams are 66% of the revenue in all of tennis.
Wow.
Four tournaments, four tournaments. And if you look at sort of the revenues of, you know, the PGA Tour compared to the ATP Tour, you know, it's a fraction of what golf is bringing in. So while we've had all these silos and kind of alphabet soup, other sports have lapped us. And we need to realize that, you know, the competition is not within. The competition is external. It's all the other sports and entertainment properties that are fighting for market share and mind share. And, you know, I think it's fantastic that the seven stakeholders have been meeting more and more even before COVID hit.
Right.
Because we need to collaborate, you know, we need to do more together, collaborate more, and make this sport more of a, you know, easier for fans to follow. You know, there's probably too many tournaments. It gets very confusing. And then along comes, you know, against that backdrop, along comes COVID, which has proven that tennis is not recession proof. And, you know, we are, you know, broadcasters and sponsors and partners are likely going to course correct their revenues. They've already started. Look at all the tournaments that haven't been able to operate. If the Connecticut Open missed 1 year of operating, we would have been out of business. We didn't have $5 million in the bank to we didn't have those reserves.
Yeah, so the majority of the tennis, the professional tournaments out there are in the same boat as the Connecticut Open, the majority, not the big ones, but most of the tournaments.
Right. Everybody has a different financial situation, but it would be very hard for many tournaments to sit out for a year and not operate and come back the next year. And so, you know, my heart goes out to, you know, all those tournaments with such great histories and great markets and great fans and great sponsors. You know, it's, you know, this is this virus and this global, you know, lockdown is really going to leave a scar.
Well,
but, you know, there's that famous quote, never let a good crisis go to waste. Like, this is a real opportunity for even more
Collaboration, right? Yeah. Well, we'll see if it happens. The jury's out on if that will happen, but we certainly all hope that it does. So let's move over to Universal Tennis, which is where you started, I guess, almost 2 years ago now. And you guys have sort of taken over what I call, you know, junior tennis, and the rating system is basically in lieu of a ranking system. So everyone's got a rating, starting from a 10-year-old kid who plays locally to Serena Williams and Roger Federer. So why did you decide that this was the right move for you?
Yeah, good question. When we sold the tournament, which was very sad, but it was amazing to hear how the tournament had touched so many people's lives over 21 years. I was going to take time off because I hadn't taken time off. I been working straight through, having kids, and feeling like my hair was on fire, driving up and down I-95 for 21 years.
Right.
And so I thought, okay, I'm gonna take some time off. But when you sell your tournament to China, and it's very public news, there's no, everyone knows you're available.
Mm-hmm.
So all kinds of interesting things, came through the email and phone and WNBA and U.S. Golf Association and opportunities in tennis, opportunities outside tennis, board positions. And it was a lot of fun just networking with people, friends from, being in the business for 35 years. And it's amazing how, broadcaster friends and sponsor friends and league friends, all different, leagues, everybody just opened up their offices and their, advice. And it was really, really fun to network.
Mm-hmm.
And, then Tony Godsick introduced me to Mark Leschly.
Sure.
And I didn't know anything about Universal Tennis because UTR is all about the grassroots game.
Right.
And so in pro tennis, we didn't talk about it a lot, didn't know about a lot back then. And so the more I learned about it, the more I was attracted to join this like digitally savvy company who can move really fast to get things done as opposed to governing bodies.
Mm-hmm.
And, only had one interest, and that's the consumer, the tennis player.
Mm.
There's no politics. It's just all about the consumer. And so, I was really kind of seduced by the opportunity to use 35 years on all sides of the sport, the player side, the tournament side, the governance side, the sponsor side, the NJTL side, to grow the game at the grassroots level, which, after being a part of our New Haven experience, how passionate I am about growing the game
right.
at the grassroots and community level. So it was a chance to use all my experience and perspective and relationships to grow tennis at the grassroots level using technology.
Well, that's the thing. And you said something so interesting, the consumer, the consumer is number one. And tennis could learn mm-hmm. a lot from Universal Tennis and what they've been doing.
Mm-hmm. So it's been like and I had to get out of my comfort zone with technology because I needed to learn a lot more. And, if you would have told me 20 months ago that I would be on all these tech platforms and, living in this technology world and as comfortable as I am, and I've just learned so much. I have really, really great team, so much respect for my team. And, we're 2020 was this incredible growth year where, the rating has a 12-year history. It was mm-hmm. founded by college coaches in Virginia, and because college coaches needed a gold standard for recruiting, they couldn't go and
travel all over the world.
They didn't have the time or the money.
They
couldn't ever travel all over the world. So the rating is still the core or the foundation of the company. But Universal Tennis, since Mark Leschly bought the company 3 years ago with partners like Team 8, Roger Federer's company, and Tennis Channel, and Tennis Australia, and Larry Ellison, and Novak Djokovic, a whole entire engagement platform has been built with tools and technologies to to drive participation and play. So there's tools and technologies for high school play, mm-hmm. for college play, for clubs, for academies, for NJPLs. And so there's, you know, something like 2.3 million profiles on the platform and 20 million results from 200 countries. And 2020, COVID, was a blockbuster year where we saw meteoric growth, you know, more than $3 million in prize money tournaments played on the platform, 47% increase in player growth, 183% increase in the clubs on the platform, the number of clubs.
Including our club. Yep, including our club, the John McEnroe Academy. And, yeah.
Yep. Very proud of your academy. And 92% increase in the number of events run on the platform, which would include the events at your academy.
Yep. Of which there are many. You know, now there's some companies and groups that sort of figure out in during this, especially in this last year. And you guys have done that. I mean, it's been an amazing to see it. You know, I knew about UTR obviously years ago, but to see the way it's blossomed in the last year has just been a testament to your guys, you know, the vision and then even more important, the implementation.
Yep. No, I mean, everything is so like optimized and automated and scaled. You know, we've just come out with, you know, Flex Leagues in August, which are going very, very well all over the country. Just introduced Universal Team Tennis for juniors. Flex Leagues is largely for adults, very, very, you know, it's like playing a league in counterparts, so there's no large gatherings during COVID, so that's been very well received. And then we just this week announced Universal Team Tennis, and the response is overwhelming. The response was overwhelming from our existing partner clubs all over the country Universal Team Tennis in local markets.
It's an absolutely huge success story, and I almost think like we're gonna need to do another podcast because I've already kept you on longer than I promise you because it's so your story is so amazing.
And you have a board meeting.
And I have a board meeting to get to, but for our charity at our tennis academy. But I do want to follow up on some more UTR stuff because I think it's amazing. And again, credit to you and to Mark, who I've known for many, many years. And the whole team, because I know it's a team effort. Steven Amitrage, my buddy from the USTA, who's there as well. So keep up the great work, and I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you.
And I feel like we could go on for another hour easily.
Yeah, I know. It's great to be reconnected with you, and I'm glad I have the right cell phone now. And we're happy to come back and talk Universal Tennis anytime. You just let me know.
You're the best. And Worcester, everyone.
Or maybe we'll even get Mark on.
You got that
Thank
right.
Thank you so much, Patrick.
You're a true trailblazer. And Worcester, everyone.
Aw, you too.
Take
Thank
care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You got
Bye.
It.
Holding Court with Patrick McEnroe is powered by Mudhouse Media.